Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Preceptor Podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Ryan, and we have with us today a Manchester alumni, Zach Brown, Dr. Zach Brown, I should say. Zach, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Ryan. So like Ryan said, my name is Zach Brown. I graduated from Manchester University College of Pharmacy in 2021. I'm currently completing a residency at Parkview Health here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, doing an academia rotation right now with Dr. Jennifer Campbell, and I'm really excited to kind of talk about what we're going to talk about today.
And in continuing with our theme of pregnancy-related topics, apparently, this is a hot time for that, we are going to be talking a little bit about a recent study that came out that talks about aspirin use in pregnancy. And so just to start us out, could you tell us what's the history of using aspirin during pregnancy?
Yeah, for sure. I honestly wasn't super sure when you guys had approached me with this topic. It wasn't something I was super familiar with. So I did have to do a little bit of digging. And from what I found historically, there hasn't really been a lot of evidence to show that patients needed to use aspirin in pregnancy. And really why these pregnant patients would use aspirin during their pregnancy would be to prevent something that we call preeclampsia. And so when we think about kind of the mechanism of aspirin itself and what that theoretical benefit is for using aspirin in pregnancy, I think it's important to remember that aspirin is one of our NSAID drugs, so a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory that works primarily on two of our cyclooxygenase isoenzymes, COX-1 and COX-2. And at that lower dose, that baby aspirin dose of 81 milligrams a day, we're really only inhibiting that COX-1 isoenzyme. And so the idea behind preeclampsia is that you can have decreased platelet synthesis and thromboxane A2 secondary to using the aspirin, and there's an imbalance between prostacyclin and thromboxane A2. So the idea was that using the aspirin could help prevent that preeclampsia from occurring in the first place. And so there really wasn't a lot of studies or research showing that theoretical benefit in practice through randomized control trials until recently. So that's kind of the background on how it's been viewed kind of before the new data has come out.
Sure. And I know, the term we try to use now is low dose because we don't want to give this to babies, right?
Sure.
But it's interesting. We're talking about it now. So what has changed recently? What have you seen?
Yeah, so really the new emergence of some newer literature. So there's a couple of studies that I kind of wanted to highlight. The first one is going to be a randomized controlled trial from 2017. It's called the Aspirin for Evidence-Based Preeclampsia Prevention trial. They looked at about 1,800 women at high risk for preeclampsia based on a first trimester screening algorithm, and those patients got randomized either aspirin or placebo. And the authors of that study found a significant decrease in the rates of preeclampsia. So about 4.5% of patients that had the placebo intervention developed preeclampsia, and only 1.6% of patients that were randomized to aspirin developed preeclampsia. So a statistically significant, and I would argue a clinically significant difference in the rates of preeclampsia between those two groups. Additionally, the United States Preventive Task Force also published a guideline citing a systematic review that they did of a number of different randomized controlled trials that looked at women at high risk for preeclampsia, and they also showed that low-dose aspirin usage was benefiting patients from preventing preeclampsia from occurring. They also showed that the differences in things like adverse effects were similar between the two groups as well. And then that guideline that they came out with really broke it down into a couple of different groups. So they noted that in patients in the high-risk groups, or patients at highest risk for preeclampsia, had a much lower number needed to treat of about 50 women compared to patients at lower risk for preeclampsia. So that guideline really says that in patients at highest risk, we should be using that lower dose aspirin of 81 milligrams a day, and it's more of a risk-benefit decision in the patients that fall in that moderate to low group.
Just for our audience who might not be familiar with those risk factors, can you highlight maybe what a couple of those would be for those patients?
Yeah, for sure. So a couple of those risk factors specifically that guideline looked at, the high risk factors, the ones that put the women at the highest risk for preeclampsia, would be things like a history of preeclampsia, multifetal gestation, or renal disease, also diabetes, whether that be type 1 or type 2, would be all risk factors that would be considered high risk factors. And the guideline basically says if patients have any of those risk factors, they just need one to qualify for needing that aspirin intervention. And then more of the moderate risk factors, so patients would need more than one moderate risk factor, the combination of a moderate plus a high risk factor, would be things like if it's the patient's first pregnancy, if the woman is 35 years or older, a BMI of 30, maybe family history of preeclampsia. Those are some of those risk factors broken down from those two groups.
It's interesting that diabetes is a high risk factor, and we're talking a lot right now about not using aspirin for prevention and just diabetes in general, but we're going to start using it more in women who are pregnant with diabetes. So it's just interesting how you kind of see those changes happen. So I think the first thing I think of, aspirin in pregnancy, I'm like, no, because, you know, we've been so ingrained that you don't give aspirin to babies. And because of, you know, Reye syndrome. Mm-hmm. So is there a risk to that? Are we concerned about possible development of that in a fetus?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's definitely a great concern to have, one that usually always comes to the mind, like Ryan alluded to earlier, right? That's one of the biggest misnomers in pharmacy is the term baby aspirin. So trying to use that low dose aspirin kind of nomenclature. As well. But I think to answer that question, kind of breaking it down and do a couple steps, the first thing I think we have to look at is, does aspirin cross the placenta? Well, it does. Aspirin does cross the placenta. And then secondly, what is Reye syndrome, or kind of what are the outcomes associated with that, and why are we concerned about it? And essentially, for those of you that maybe aren't as familiar, so Reye syndrome is this rapidly progressive encephalopathy that happens secondary to hepatic dysfunction in these patients, and they can often experience things like increased intracranial pressure that leads to significant morbidity and mortality as well. The exact cause of Reye syndrome is unknown, so how it got linked to aspirin kind of originally is that patients that were recovering from different viral infections, flu or chickenpox, we're often using aspirin to kind of be treated from that, or to kind of aid in some of those symptoms that they were having, and that just kind of turned into the triggering this kind of syndrome that we call Reye syndrome. And it's incredibly rare, so it typically occurs in less than 1% of patients 18 years or younger that are receiving aspirin. So it's pretty rare in those patients that do receive aspirin if they're 18 or younger anyway. Specifically for pregnant patients, I wasn't really able to find any of those randomized control trials that laid that out specifically in the adverse effects section of their articles. I couldn't find any case reports of that either happening in pregnant patients or the fetus developing Reye syndrome. There was a 2019 review, Cochrane review done, that looked at a lot of those adverse effects between aspirin and placebo in pregnant patients. And they found no difference in many, both fetal and maternal risks, including things like something that presents a little bit similar to Reye syndrome is something called HELLP syndrome. So hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes and low platelets is something that is somewhat similar. And they found no difference in risk between those patients that received aspirin and placebo. So I think kind of taking a look at all that, it's definitely a risk benefit decision and talk that needs to be had with the patient the patient's provider. But essentially, from what we're finding from the reviews, it's not happening, or at least it's not being reported in those different reviews that we've been looking at.
This is why when my husband says a computer could do what a pharmacist does, I say no, they can't, because this risk benefit part is really important. And I think I was joking with some students the other day, I think all pharmacists should get risk versus benefit like tattooed on their on their arm or something, because that's like what we say so much.
I don't know if that's going to catch on in the pharmacy student community, but I'm in support of that. Really interesting stuff on Reye syndrome too. So it sounds like it really is more linked to and tell me if I'm wrong or reading too much, but it sounds like it's more linked to a viral infection, and then maybe a trigger of some sort from aspirin related to that, or at least there might be some interplay there.
Yeah. So I think that's exactly right. You know, we're not really able to link directly, you know, if it's the aspirin alone or if it is a combination of the patient just recovering from some sort of viral infection in general. So I think it's really interesting. It's something to definitely think about when you're considering using the aspirin in this patient population.
That's interesting too, because I think we all learn that Reye's syndrome is just like, this is it. And
it's like,
it's going to happen. And now to kind of have that more nuanced feeling, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I thought it was like much more like an allergic reaction. And,
yeah.
Maybe there's something to that, but there's more going on, it sounds like. That's really interesting. Well, anything else that our listeners should know about these patients?
Yeah, so I think we touched on risk a little bit, maternal and fetal risk, kind of talking about that 2019 review. But I think going into that, just really quickly a little bit more to put maybe recommending this to different providers for whether it's, you know, pharmacists, whoever's listening to this podcast, making that recommendation to make you a little bit more comfortable with making that recommendation. I want to talk about maternal and fetal risk. So in terms of maternal risk or risk to the mother, in this case, there have been a few randomized controlled trials that found no difference in adverse effects. So things that you would think of, you know, with aspirin in general would be things like hemorrhagic complications, whether it be during birth or kind of pre-birth as well. So that same United States Preventative Task Force report showed that in those patients that had benefit from receiving the aspirin had no difference in those hemorrhagic complications as well. Typically, if the patient's using it longer term, of course, that risk is going to increase. But if we're kind of limiting it to kind of that 12 weeks of gestation onto birth, you know, we're kind of limiting the amount of time that the patient's getting exposure to that drug. So that risk is definitely lower from a time perspective as well.
So based on that, it's not... I know sometimes when we're going to do like surgery for a patient, we advise them to stop their aspirin so many days in advance.
Mm-hmm.
There's not really, based on this study, this review, there's not really a need to stop it pre-labor if you knew you were going to have like an induction or something like that. It seems like it's safe to continue it through towards that.
That's correct. That's from the data and the studies that I've looked at, it seems like they've continued the aspirin, whether it be up to, you know, natural birth or induction. They haven't really specified a stop date kind of pre-birth in those cases.
Well, that's good. Because sometimes birth doesn't always happen when
sure.
you think it
yeah,
should.
Exactly. Right. And then kind of on the flip side of that too, right, that fetal risk. So we talked a little bit about Reye's syndrome, but some other things that have been of interest to some different authors have been things like congenital abnormalities or anomalies. No difference in outcomes of those between placebo groups and patients that have received aspirin in the fetus or in the babies when they're born. And that included about 1,300 women. 615 of those women actually had aspirin previous to becoming pregnant, so they were kind of on aspirin prior to that, and they continued it throughout the pregnancy. So no risk of things like neonatal intracranial hemorrhage, so again, bleeding complications that we would expect, or hemorrhagic complications in general with the fetus either. So as far as is that fetal risk, it seems like there's really no added risk. Of course, there's always the possibility of those different things occurring, but kind of from the data that we have, there's no real statistical difference between those outcomes from patients that receive aspirin to patients that don't or patients that have that placebo. And then one thing that I don't know if we quite touched on it, is really the timing of starting aspirin to prevent that preeclampsia either. I just want to make sure we're a little bit clear about that. So the current recommendation from ACOG and from the United States Preventative Task Force is that if we're going to start aspirin for preeclampsia prophylaxis, it's recommended that we start it between 12 weeks and 28 weeks of gestation, and it's optimally before 16 weeks. So that 12 to 16 week is kind of the sweet spot on when we should be starting that aspirin if the patient has those high risk factors or multiple moderate risk factors for developing preeclampsia during the pregnancy as well.
And just to clarify, because that's a really good call out, so thanks for sharing that. If a patient were to develop preeclampsia, is this something that could be a treatment, or they're really, so far, they've really only studied prevention?
Yeah, so from what I've seen, it's really just been prevention. As far as treatment goes, again, going back to that theoretical benefit, it makes sense, at least in my mind, how adding aspirin could potentially help prevent some of that imbalance of thromboxane A2 and prostacyclin that's occurring. So I think that could be really interesting to look at in the future, patients that do develop preeclampsia, maybe starting the aspirin secondary to that more of as a treatment versus more of that prevention. But I think most of the data and these recommendations are for prevention as of right now.
Sure. Wow. I've learned a lot. Thank you so much for sharing. Yeah, this has been really good. Thanks so much for being here today,
Zach. Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. And thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Pharmacy Preceptor Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please like or subscribe. We would love your feedback on topics that interest you and how we can make this podcast better. Please submit your comments to help us develop content that best serves you. Thanks, everyone.